Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up today, speaking to the United States Ambassador to the Holy See, Kenneth Hackett, who presented his letters of credence to Pope Francis this past week. Bringing you part three in our series Once a Jesuit, Always a Jesuit. That's with Jesuit historian Professor Norman Tanner. Marking the month of October with a musical meditation focusing on the fourth Joyful Mystery of the Rosary, a programme presented by Monsignor Philip Whitmore. And as weekend celebrations here in the Vatican revolve around family issues, we join our popular Latin lover to speak of the right of children to play, respected, as you'll discover, long before the Convention of the Rights of the Child was signed. But first, as always at this time of week, why don't I bring you the Pope and the People, a report on the weekly general audience of Pope Francis with pilgrims from across the world. For this, we joined Susie Hodges.
At his general audience, Pope Francis continued his catechesis on the model of the Church and reflected on how Mary is a model of faith and charity. He said Mary's life was centered on Christ, the incarnation of God's infinite love. She teaches us to live a life of faith by her obedience to God's will and by her unfailing devotion to Jesus and his work. As a model of charity, the Pope continued, Mary wishes to bring all of us to the great gift that is Jesus, with his love, his peace, and his joy. The Church, he said, is not a shop,
La Chiesa non è un negozio,
or a humanitarian agency, or an NGO. The Church's mandate is to bring Christ and the gospel to everyone. The Church brings Jesus and his love, and if the Church were not to bring Jesus, he said, it would be a dead Church. Turning to our responsibilities as Christians, Pope Francis asked, what is the nature of the love we bring to others? Is it the love of Jesus, who shares, who pardons, and who accompanies us? Or is it a weak love that looks for favours in return, a love based on self-interest? Our love towards others must be a free love, he said. And as he has done in the past, he warned the faithful against gossip and speaking ill of our brothers and sisters in our dealings with those in our community or in our parish.
Nessuno parla male di l'altro.
The Pope concluded by urging those present to maintain a constant relationship and profound friendship with Jesus, and not just to remember him when we have problems and need his help. I'm Susie Hodges.
And our thanks there go to Susie Hodges for bringing us this report. Time now to join the United States' new ambassador to the Holy See, Kenneth Hackett, who dropped by our studios here this past week following his presentation of letters of credence to Pope Francis. Let's listen to what he told Tracy McClure.
I had never met the Holy Father before, and I've met a lot of cardinals and churchmen and women around the world, but never him. And having read and heard and seen so much of what he had done, just to actually meet him was inspiring and an honor. And we exchanged, obviously, pleasantries and aspirations, and obviously I told him that we hope we can work together on many, many issues that affect human dignity and the poor and people who are marginalized. I told him that I had experienced in my many years many people in the Church who have been courageous, intrepid, people who have done wonderful, wonderful things. Sometimes we hear about the negative and we don't hear about the really positive things mm-hmm. that are done around the world.
Now, many of your predecessors in this job as ambassadors, they have focused on certain areas, human trafficking, promoting human rights, interreligious dialogue. Are you going to be focusing on international human development? I mean, that's what you've been working in more than 40 years. What area are you going to pick up on?
All of those areas, regrettably, are still in need, and I will pick up on them. In my previous positions. I was engaged in all of those. International human development is something that the Holy Father has spoken about. I mean, then he talks about the situation of refugees. Well, obviously, that would fall in the human trafficking and the movement of people. And it's something that is of concern to my government very much. And it is an area where we have collaborated with the Holy See and will continue to. And if we can do more in human development and peace issues, I hope we can. And I hope, as I said earlier, that I can use my connections and contacts from the past to try to enhance those efforts in any way.
And you were listening there to the United States new ambassador to the Holy See, Kenneth Hackett, who prior to this posting gave 40 years of service to the Catholic Relief Services. He was speaking there to Tracy McClure. Time now to mark the month of October with a musical meditation, focusing on the fourth, Joyful Mystery of the Rosary, a programme presented by music historian Monsignor Philip Whitmore.
Mary and Joseph came to the temple to present the child Jesus to the Lord, as the law required. The presentation in the temple is the fourth joyful mystery of the Rosary. We celebrate it liturgically 40 days after Christmas on the Feast of Candlemas, when we process with lighted candles, bearing witness before the world to the light of Christ. In fact, Simeon describes Jesus as Lumen ad Revelationem Gentium, a light to enlighten the Gentiles.
Lumen ad revelationem gentium, et gloriam plebis tuae Israel.
For our musical meditation today, I'd like to focus on the figure of Simeon. He is presented to us as an old man, devout and upright, faithful to the traditions of Israel. He's one of those pivotal figures between the Old and New Testaments. For most of his life, he was waiting for the Messiah to come. But at the end of his life, he had the privilege of seeing for himself the one who would bring salvation to his people. Senex puerum portabat, the old man carried the child, yet the child was the old man's king. The setting of the Magnificat Antiphon for First Vespers on the Feast of the Presentation was composed by William Byrd, a Catholic composer in the reign of Elizabeth I. It's included in a large collection of music that he wrote for use in Catholic worship behind closed doors in the homes of the aristocracy, because Catholic worship in England at that time was strictly against the law of the land. William Byrd enjoyed special favour with Queen Elizabeth, who knew a good composer when she heard one. Although he was a Catholic, he was employed to write music for the Chapel Royal for much of his life. Not only did the Queen apparently not mind him being a Catholic, but there is evidence that she privately paid him an allowance to help him meet the cost of the fines he incurred as a result. He returned the compliment by composing the most glorious music for the liturgy of the Chapel Royal.
Oh.
We've been listening to the Nunc Dimittis from Byrd's Great Service. Lord, now lettest thou thy servant depart in peace according to thy word. This is the third of the great gospel canticles that form part of the daily liturgy of the hours, and St. Luke places it on the lips of Simeon during the scene of the presentation of the Lord in the temple. It's a marvelous prayer. Simeon acknowledges the privilege he has been given, and he speaks prophetically of the light that Jesus will bring to all the nations of the world. I'd like to finish with a more modern setting of the Nunc Dimittis. It was written by Gustav Holst for the choir of Westminster Cathedral in 1915. Listen to the energy of those repeated phrases, Lumen ad Revelationem Gentium, and the exaltation of the concluding Et Gloriam Plebis Tuae Israel. With joy let us contemplate the infant Jesus, who is indeed the light to enlighten the Gentiles, and the glory of his people Israel.
And warm thanks there, as always, to Monsignor Philip Widmore, a music historian who's currently rector of the Venerable English College here in Rome. I'd now like to bring you part three in our series Once a Jesuit, Always a Jesuit. That's with Jesuit historian Professor Norman Tanner. There haven't been that many popes who belong to religious orders.
Yes, that's right. The overwhelming majority is certainly from the Dowson clergy. However, there have been a number. The last one who was a member of the religious order was a Benedictine in the 1800s, Pope Gregory the 16th. So it's not so completely unusual.
Historically, how would you say that the Jesuits as an order are placed? It's the largest religious order, isn't it? Also had prime of place for a long time, no?
Yes, that's correct. We're 18,000 now. Just to put it in perspective, when I joined some 50 years ago, we were 36,000. So it's been a difficult time, and that's true of nearly all the other orders. The last 50 years has seen shrinkage. Of course, there are other groups who are considerably larger than us, the Franciscans, but they are actually officially distinguished into different Franciscan orders.
What do you think is the place of the Jesuit order within a historical context in the history of the Catholic Church?
It's played a big role in the Church's history in the last 500 years since foundation, as you said, in the Counter-Reformation, and also the 19th century and 20th century. We are conscious that a lot is being asked of us, as well as you say, the actual largest. Perhaps we're the most international, with presence in all five continents and in most countries. So a big range of different kinds of works we do. So the spiritual side, with the retreat houses and spiritual direction, is very fundamental. There's also all the educational work in schools and universities, and wider here, the Radio Vaticana and other communications work, and many other types of work. So it's a great honour to have this wide range of things to do, but also a big responsibility. So yes, we are stretched, and we need more novices, more people to join the order. So if any people are thinking, yes, you're very welcomed and recommended to think of joining. We do need more people.
You're inviting people to join the Jesuits. Why would one join the Jesuits today?
Well, I might say it's two things. You need the call from God, but you also need the individual's response. And we feel sure, and with papal confirmations and so on of the Church, that the order still has a significant role to play. But equally, the individual's got to feel at home in this family. But what is certain is, from the church's point of view, that he will have plenty of good works to be able to do.
In terms of?
Well, of course, we live under obedience, and sometimes you're given a job which is the last thing you'd want to do. But if it's from obedience, you know that's still a higher call, and somehow God's grace comes to you. But normally, our superiors try to fit the individual into work that's suitable for him. So some will be good at giving retreats, others will be good in teaching in classrooms, or writing articles, or giving interviews on Radio Vaticana, or the Speculo Vaticana at Castel Gandolfo, the great work there. There is a huge range of works, and then those might be the more fulfilling works, but those who suffer and do works in mission countries, maybe, where they may end up by being expelled from the country, or even in martyrdom. Of course, we have a great tradition, as in the church as a whole, of martyrs whom we honour above all. So those also works which seem to be unfruitful at the time can bring the richest fruit of all.
One of the things people always talk about when you speak about Jesuits in Latin America is liberation theology. Where does Pope Francis stand in terms of his approach to liberation theology? First of all, what is liberation theology? Not everyone knows.
And there are two senses of liberation theology, I suppose, that in a very fundamental sense, Christ came to liberate us all, to set us all free from the powers of evil, the powers of death, and to bring us life and resurrection. But there is also another sense, a more limited one, anyway, another sense of liberation theology, which looks more at the political, social, especially the political dimension, liberation from unjust political and social structures. So it's been focused principally on countries where these unjust political or social structures seem to be the most evident. Latin America, South America, was one area in which this idea that Christians or Catholics, because Catholics are so numerous there, the majority in most of the countries, they felt an obligation, some, to not simply work for liberation in the normal sense of good works, but also to overturn unjust political and social structures. So you get into the area of struggle, but also political and maybe even military struggle, taking up arms. And that's where it obviously enters into more difficult waters.
And in terms of where Pope Francis stands in this area?
So Francis lived in Argentina in a very difficult situation of the military dictatorship, and he was both rector of the theologate, so in charge of the young Jesuits, and also for 6 years provincial, so with overall responsibility for the Jesuits in that large country. He certainly always emphasized the importance of the Christian life brings liberation, but he was very cautious about engaging in direct political struggle, as some of his fellow Jesuits wished the Jesuits to do.
What has struck you most so far in terms of this pontificate, first of all as a Jesuit?
We're very honoured that one of our members of our order has been chosen, obviously. I, like most of my other Jesuits, was surprised. We knew, of course, that he'd been Cardinal Archbishop of Buenos Aires, and we understand that he, at the last conclave, when Pope Benedict was elected, he received a considerable, significant number of votes. However, we assume that he's 8 years later, at age 76, he would be too old to be considered. So when he was elected rapidly, I think a mixture of joy and thanks and maybe also some nervousness as to how a member of our order, who had nevertheless been the Archbishop of Buenos Aires for many years and so was out of the normal day-to-day running of the society, would look upon the society. So there certainly was some mixture of gratitude and nervousness, quickly turning, I think, to... Well, indeed, pleasure and joy that he's been so well received by the church and by the wider world, but also humility, prayers and hopes that things will continue to go well and our prayers for him.
And as a historian, are there any moments that you would like to pinpoint?
Well, surely it's a new step in the life of the church. If you look in the early church, of course, we think of the popes always being Italians or Europeans, but of course Peter was an Asian from the Holy Land, and a number of the early popes, in fact, were either from Asia, Western Asia, of course, or from a few from Africa too. But then we had for a long time, from about 1500 onwards, always 400 years or so, nearly 500 years, always Italians. And that mold, of course, that was changed with the election of John Paul II in 1978, and then with Benedict. But to choose a man from outside the Mediterranean or Western world and to go, as the Pope himself said, to the far ends of the world, this is a very significant step. Because the Catholic Church has become such a worldwide church, and we forget it's only really quite relatively recently, from the 1500s onwards, and especially from the 1800s, the church has really been present in all corners of the globe. So it's very good that the Catholic Church is now, obviously a worldwide church, is now represented at this highest level from a person from South America, a continent which is so important for the Catholic Church, which where so many Catholics live and work. And so I think also the other countries are pleased, not just Argentine, but there's a sense that perhaps the church in its government and higher personnel has been too much European, Western. And so I think the wider church is pleased that one of their own, as it were, has now been elected.
And you were listening there to Jesuit historian and well-known author Father Norman Tanner in Once a Jesuit, Always a Jesuit. Finally, on a totally different note, as weekend celebrations revolve around family issues, I'd like you to join our popular Latin lover, Carmelite Father Reginald Foster, to speak of the right of children to play at the time of the Romans. Mm-hmm. Roman children played.
Oh, yeah. Certainly they had games and they had toys and they had all that.
They played the nuts, the equivalent of marbles, I read.
Yes.
How'd you say that?
Nuce, they had a whole thing. Nucibus ludebant. Nucibus ludebant with, like, walnuts.
But they played with knuckle bones or pebbles as well.
Yeah. And certainly they used to carve, you know, ivory cubes, like, okay, your dice.
Oh, but the adults used to play dice.
Oh, yeah, from your foot there.
So how do you say knuckle bones? And the Romans played with knuckle bones and pebbles and rolled metal hoops.
Oh, my Lord. Yeah, I know. The metal hoops is a verbero. Ergo, volvebant verberones. That's the hoops. I don't know, knuckle bones. What are you going to say? Osa articulorum. Oh, they had everything.
Yeah. The little girls had dolls as well, didn't they?
Oh, yeah, certainly. Even in Pompeii, we had, like, you know, carts and little horses. Well, they had everything that we have today, for sure.
What do you mean, carts and little horses?
I mean, they had, you know, model horses and
like
wagons.
Toys.
And toys, yeah, certainly.
Toys representing
their everyday life. Yeah, certainly. Oblectamenta, ludibria.
Those toys were for rich children, no?
Mm.
Maybe poorer children just made little carts with a bit of wood and they... And I read that they had little mice or pigeons to pull them.
Oh, yeah, certainly.
How would you say that?
Well, we have pictures like that.
How would you say that?
Avevan colum, mures, vel palumbes, qui traherent curus, caros.
And they must have played what you call in the States tag, no?
Oh, yeah, my, yeah.
How'd you say tag?
What do you understand by tag? I know, you know. What are you
going to
say?
We call it chasing.
Yeah, I know. What are you going to say? I don't know. Tactus est vera, you know, tactus for contractatio, where you touch someone.
And what about hide and seek?
Se abscondere et querere. That's easy.
And hopscotch.
Oh, my heaven's sakes. Saltatio per quadra. Jumping through the squares. What are you going to say? Saltatio, boom, 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 per quadra.
And they like to play games, as we said before, with dice and things like that. And they used to play things like, you know, what we do too as well when you toss a coin, no? Heads I win and tails you lose.
Yeah.
How'd you say
that? They had the same thing. Capita? What do they say? Capita. Yeah. Caput me vincente et...
Navia.
Huh?
Navia.
Navia?
No.
What is Navia?
I don't know. I read that in a book.
Navia. Maybe, yeah, where they had like with tails, in the sense like a ship on the back. That would be possible with the head and a ship. They had things like certainly the Roman coins.
So cheating again. Heads I win, tails you lose, how'd you say?
Si arcidit caput vinco, si cauda evenit perdo.
They were great gamblers, the Romans, weren't they? Those were...
Oh, yeah.
How do you say gambling?
Oh, that's another one. That's hard to do, too, you know. Hey, what are you going to say? Per sortes. Ludebon per sortes. Mm. By lots.
They gambled of everything, didn't they? They had cockfights and all the rest of it.
Oh, yeah.
Blackmailing, you were saying?
Wanted blackmail. I said there's not one word, but they say extorquere minis, to extort something with threats.
Getting back to the children, did they go to the baths at all? Because the adults spent a lot of time in the baths.
Yes, they did. They did with their parents. Yes, they did. Babies were taken there.
Did they swim?
Yes, certainly.
How do you say?
Certainly.
Throw the baby into the thermal pool.
In piscina, in infantulum proicere.
They went on picnics on a particular festival in March, you know, by the Tiber.
Mm.
Is that right?
I'm not acquainted with it in
March. Did they go on picnics?
Yeah, they had rusticaciones.
Would you say that the children were respected and that they did have rights in the times of the Romans?
Rights, I don't know, not rights. That would be hard to say as we understand rights. Respected, oh yes. Oh yeah, but as we would understand rights, perhaps not.
How would you describe it?
Because, you don't understand, because the children were subjected to their father. What they call the patria potestas was extremely strong. The father had control over his children as long as he lived, even if the kids were 50 years old. And the father was 90, he still had control over the children.
So the Romans never grew up?
Numquam adulem erunt Romani, they never grew up. But there are incidents, really, where children, even older adults, disobeyed their parents and were killed by the parents.
That's pushing it a bit far, no?
Well, that was they had that sacrosanct thing. It was patria potestas, fatherly authority.
A child asked you today, Father Foster, what were the Roman children like?
Well, I would say, listen, all you have to do is change your clothes a bit and put on a little toga or a little one of those little cut-off, you know, dresses up to your knee and sandals, and you're the same as they always were. Habene habevan tuniculas. Et satis es mutare vestimenta ut fiatis pueri Romanorum, that you become children of the Romans. Am pervenimus ad lunam, interia nil est vita humana mutata.
Which means, in English?
Which means we have gotten to the moon, but the human life has changed nothing.
And a big thank you there to our popular Latin lover, Carmelite, Father Reginald Foster, who was for many years and under many popes, papal Latinist. No longer in Rome, he is currently teaching Latin in the United States. And that's all I have time for on today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks so much for listening. Don't forget, I'll be back again at the same time tomorrow, so be sure to join me then. Laudetur Jesus Christus.